It's a Dave Kohler, me solo Friday postgame edition. Me solo, it's kind of like a mixture between Me Too and Han Solo, except I'm not going to talk about either of those two things, so it's not really that relevant. But what I do want to do is give a postgame show for Friday for all the members who deserve it, because the main show hosts, as we always explain, like to cut out early on Friday, and I don't really blame them. In fact, though, when we've done this postgame show in the past couple of weeks with Malcolm and all, I don't think we've acknowledged that in the past couple of months there are thousands of new members. So welcome and thank you to all the thousands of new members. Maybe some of you aren't even that familiar with the Dave Kohler versions of the Friday postgame shows, so you might be a little freaked out. I don't blame you. I did one 2 weeks ago. My favorite comment in there was the simplest one. It just said, I like this guy. And what that told me is it's a viewer who didn't know who I was. He doesn't even know my name. He just said, I like this guy. He watched me for the first time, and he said he liked me. That's good. He's not biased. It was a pure, unbiased, new, objective judgment he made, and it was in my favor. So I was cool with that. So I'm going to go all around. There's not a good, clear theme today. It's going to be a little bit of a variety show of a postgame. And let's get started with a story that is pretty mainstream. It's brief, but I want to take it in a slight different direction. This is earlier this week, the U.S. ambassador to NATO made some belligerent comment about Russian missiles, and she said she would, I don't remember the exact words, but the U.S. was going to have to take those missiles out. And Russia made big diplomatic kerfuffle over this because it was a very aggressive comment and very vague and belligerent from an American diplomat, and the Russia got a little bit of diplomatic mileage out of embarrassing the United States on that. And they're right, the U.S. shouldn't be making, but it's the Trump administration, so of course we're going to make, you know, belligerent, not well thought out comments like that. And who is the U.S. ambassador to NATO? It's old friend Kay Bailey Hutchison. She was a senator, longtime Republican senator from Texas during the Bush era. And so she was much discussed on the Young Turks, which is why I call her ironically an old friend. And it got me to think, where are some of those other senators that we talked about almost every day on the Young Turks? What are they, are now out of the Senate? What are they doing now? I looked a few up and it was pretty boring. Most of them are lobbyists. Let's go. Kay Bailey Hutchison is the NATO ambassador to NATO. That's different. A lot of them are lobbyists. Bill Frist, former Senate majority leader, actually has had a decent career after the Senate. He wrote a letter to an editorial to the Washington Post earlier this summer, strongly urging Republicans to back the Mueller investigation. And he's been involved, Bill Frist has been involved in a lot of charities for healthcare and education. I'm sure he's still a Republican right winger at heart, but it seems like he's doing some decent stuff in his post-Senate career. It's much better, at least, than all the other former senators I found who are just lobbyists for their former corporate donors. Another what's happened to me now is I just randomly fell upon, I'll give the name, David Wildstein. You can spend 5 seconds trying to think of who that is, David Wildstein. But he was the central figure in Chris Christie's Bridgegate scandal. He was actually the Port Authority official who closed the bridge, actually did the closing of the bridge in Fort Lee to create that traffic jam that Chris Christie and his administration directed to embarrass the Fort Lee mayor. He cooperated with authorities in their investigation and their prosecution, so he got off without having to go to jail. He turned a lot of people in, turned evidence on a lot of people. And was appeared like he was just going to retire from the public spotlight, but it turns out he's created a very influential and well-read blog on New Jersey politics called New Jersey Globe. And he is now one of the more important, more connected people in the state power structure. Everybody wants to be in touch with him, Democrats and Republicans, because he's writing an influential blog that other important people are reading. I haven't checked it out yet. It's very new, I suppose, but I will. And it's just a little side note on what happened to this guy who was the central figure, although not a big household name, in the Bridgegate scandal. Speaking of Chris Christie, he got a road named after him, Chris Christie Drive in Parsippany, New Jersey. So we're responsible now, unlike maybe 10 years ago. I would have said, if you're ever in Parsippany, go to that drive and do something disrespectful. But no, you can't. So if you're ever in Parsippany and you find Chris Christie Drive, just take another road, I'd say. But Chris Christie doesn't deserve ever any roads named after him. He left New Jersey as one of the least popular governors in memory. But I guess there's a small contingent in Parsippany that liked him. So that's the where are they now. Let's change directions and do quick Dave's Graves. Let's cue that up and hit Dave's Graves. I'm going first to the passing of Leon Letterman at 96 years old. He's a former Nobel Prize winner in physics, very important in the discovery of subatomic particles, quarks, and whatnot. And, of course, every Nobel Prize winner in any science is a person of honor. In fact, this year, I think the third ever woman won the Nobel Prize in physics. I think she's the fifth woman ever to win a Nobel Prize in science. But she's alive. This is Dave's Graves segment. Leon Letterman was a Nobel Prize winner from the 80s, and he passed away. So what I try to do in Dave's Graves, I don't just tell the story of a Nobel Prize winner. All of them would be fascinating, and you'd have to explain the science and what they discovered. But I'm trying to find something else a little interesting from their obituaries. And I found two or three things about Leon Letterman. First, he was a big advocate for reversing the traditional science curriculum in schools. And what he's saying makes a lot of sense. What I grew up on is I took biology in 9th grade, chemistry in 10th grade, physics in 11th grade. And I think that's still pretty standard the way American high schools and the American school systems teach the sciences. And he said that's completely backwards. You should do physics first because it's most fundamental. Chemistry builds on it. And then biology is the more complex science that builds on physics and chemistry. So you should do them in that order. And after that, possibly, if you really want to keep going, do a course in psychology, which goes beyond physics, chemistry, and biology and starts getting weird. Makes a lot of sense. And I bet there are some schools and school districts that do that. But the standard American sequence is biology, chemistry, physics, because people consider biology to be easier and chemistry a little easier and physics to be the hardest. Another interesting part of Leon Letterman's life, so he won the Nobel Prize in the 80s, so that's 30 years ago. He was in his 60s, a healthy man. He used the money to buy a cabin in Idaho, where he planned to retire. And sure enough, after his career as a physicist, he did go to Idaho and lived in that cabin to retire. And he was still in good health, but he and his wife sold his Nobel Prize award for $700,000 and put that money toward future medical expenses. And sure enough, he needed the money for future medical expenses and medical care. He started to have dementia. So it was helpful to have that money for the treatment, for someone to take care of him. And by the end of his life, he had forgotten, sadly, this is so sad and tragic, it's the human condition, he forgot everything he ever did. He's a Nobel Prize winner in physics, one of the more important and influential physicists in the 20th century America. And at the end of his life, he knew nothing about it, forgot it all completely. Fortunately, though, for him, he planned well. He was thoughtful about his finances. And you know what? You say the Nobel Prize, it's all about the prestige and the honor, and that's true. But at the same time, it's about the money. He used the money to buy the house, and he sold the medal. What good would the actual award have done him? He was much better off turning that into money, which then turned into having someone take care of him and ease his transition into the passing later in life. So, you know, wisdom from Leon Letterman. You wouldn't expect anything less from a Nobel Prize winning physicist. And I'm going to make Bart happy. We're going to mention Jeff Emmerich, who passed away earlier this week or last week at 72. He was the chief and very innovative engineer, sound engineer for the Beatles. So I read his obit, and this is exactly the type of guy I would normally discuss on Dave's Grays, but I didn't quite get much out of it. I didn't know what I was going to say until I talked to Bart a little about how innovative he was, and in fact, what a young Turk he was. So Bart, why was he such a young Turk in the music industry?
I just kind of like, well, for one, a couple reasons. His story of how he started out as a engineer. He was 15 years old. He was an engineering assistant at EMI Studios, before it was known as Abbey Road Studios. And on the second day of work, he worked overtime, but he was not paid to work overtime. But that particular day that he worked, he witnessed the Beatles recording for the first time in that studio, Love Me Do. And then later on, he done various jobs related to that occupation at Abbey Road. And then exclusively, he was promoted by the recommendation of George Martin to become the Beatles' exclusive recording engineer in 1966. And the very first album that he worked on for the Beatles was Revolver. And the first song that he worked on was Tomorrow Never Knows. And if anyone's familiar with that song, that piece of music, there's lots of tape loops and sound effects. And he was the guy that would be there to interpret what the Beatles wanted for their ideas to be put on record. And they asked him, well, I want, John Lennon said, I want to sound like the Dalai Lama high on a mountaintop. And he would perform that task by putting a microphone in water to get a gargling effect. But instead he used a Leslie speaker, which for those who do not know what a Leslie speaker is a speaker that's used exclusively for a Hammond organ. And inside the speaker, it's encased, and inside the speaker is like a fan. And when you project your voice through that speaker, it sounds like a gargling effect. So he would use various things to interpret an artist's creativity, their ideas. And he represents breaking away from the old guard of what Abbey Road and EMI Studios used to be, because it's like, it used to be like these men were in lab coats and no artists are allowed to be inside the recording studio and touch the knobs. Well, Jeff Emmerich, he broke away from that. And he was just like, yeah, you know, I want to help out. I want to be as much as part of the process and help a group, an artist, to interpret their ideas to the best of my abilities. And that's what he did. And for me, I consider him like the sixth Beatle. And his story is incredible.
And is the fifth Beatle George Martin or that drummer guy who never played?
No, my own personal fifth opinion. The fifth Beatle for me is George Martin, right. And the sixth Beatle is Jeff Emmerich.
And is the seventh Beatle Pete Best?
No, I think the seventh Beatle would be Mal Evans. He was the Beatles' road manager, and he has some very interesting stories if you want to dive deep about Beatles folklore.
The point of Jeff Emmerich is he skyrocketed to the peak of his profession in his mid-20s, and he did it not by following convention. He did it by being a bit different and young Turkish and rebellious and breaking convention. And that's fantastic. And then he had a long career as a sound engineer.
Yeah, and the thing I like about him and how I can relate to Jeff Emmerich is like, that's how I've done things most of my life. I would go to a place and hang out. Early in my life, I worked in radio, and I went to a radio station and I hung out and I just to be a fly on the wall and watch what disc jockeys would do. And I worked in radio for a while, and to me, it sounded like having the best type of education. You know, you can go to a university scholastically, that's great and everything, but for me, it's like being out in the world and going forward and just doing what you want to do and seeing what you want to do and getting to that goal just by doing it. I think Jeff Emmerich definitely represents some of my sensibilities. And as a result of that, he won Grammys for Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road for, you know, best engineering non-classical album.
Yeah. But, you know, as a parent, though, it's so hard to say to your kid, just go do whatever you want. Give it a shot. Because you want to be conservative and you want them to go to school. But so it's tough. You got to, but people have to find their own road in life. So that's Jeff Emery. In 72, relatively young, he passed away. But yeah, for every famous celebrity like the Beatles, there's somebody behind the scenes who did a lot of the important, innovative, hard work. Okay, so that's Dave's Graves. And now we can spend the rest of the show avoiding talking about the sadness of people who have died. Quick note, some astronomers have recently found the best evidence so far of a moon outside of our solar system. It's awaiting further observation and confirmation. And I don't know how far it is from our solar system, but there's a moon outside of our solar system. Of course, we've found plenty of planets outside our solar system, but a moon is so much smaller, it's harder to find. The gravitational impact of it is harder to measure, and that's often how you find planets and moons. So the first moon outside of our solar system has been identified. We are not alone. Let's do a quick roundup of Latin America. I don't have a lot. Everyone knows who watches this show that there have been protests going on in Nicaragua for 6 months now against Daniel Ortega. Recently, Nicaragua passed an anti-terrorism law that basically bans protests in the country. So that situation is not in the news so much. I don't know really what's going on day to day, but it's not getting any better. And Daniel Ortega is not getting any more open-minded about the matter. I guess this is just going to last until the end of his term, and I hope then he goes away. But I want to contrast that to Costa Rica. I didn't know this until recently. Costa Rica's been facing protests in the streets for about a month against a tax reform plan that's going to impose austerity on the lower and middle class. But the protests are perfectly peaceful. There's no oppression. There's no violence or not significant violence. That's the way it should work. And it's not a surprise that Costa Rica, a more developed and orderly country than Nicaragua, is having protests in a proper democratic manner, where in Nicaragua, the protests are getting violently oppressed. But it's a nice contrast right there in Central America with two countries and how they deal with protests. In Peru, former President Alberto Fujimori, who was pardoned for a conviction on corruption charges and other charges at the end of last year, has been re-convicted and re-arrested and sent to jail. So Fujimori back in jail. He's the former president of Peru from the 90s who was noted at the time for defeating the Shining Path rebel group. But in the process, Fujimori became a dictator and exerted his power illegally. He was brought to justice recently. His daughter is prominent in Peruvian politics, and she and her political party lobbied hard to get him pardoned and get him out of jail, and it worked for a while, but now he's back in jail. Probably a proper thing. And that's all I have, my quick Latin American update. Now I'm going to go to Missouri. A study recently came out that the Missouri roads are in such bad shape, the infrastructure, the highways, the roads, the bridges, that it's costing each Missouri driver $1,477 per year in damage to the car, accidents, maintenance, lost time at work, etc. That one's fuzzy, and I'm annoyed that they put that in. But the bad infrastructure situation on the Missouri roads is costing each driver $1,477 per year. So why am I bringing this up? This is the classic political argument. If someone says that Missouri needs to invest whatever it is, $15 billion to improve their roads, some right winger or some guy on the news is going to say, well, where are you going to get that money? That's a lot of money. How are we going to spend that money? We are already paying that money. The drivers are paying $1,400 a year for damage to their car and wasted time and maintenance because the roads are in such crappy shape. This is the same thing that happened on TV on CNN with Jake Tapper and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez a week or two ago, and Cenk and Anna dissected that argument or that whole appearance thoroughly on the Young Turks. But in that interview, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was not concise enough in explaining that what, these things that the mainstream media or the right-wingers called government spending money are investments, and you're going to get a return on investment. And in fact, that money is already being spent, but it's coming out of your pocket instead of everybody getting together through government and taxation and spending money to fix the problem instead of always reacting to it. So it's just a small example. There are millions all across the country. Every state in the country needs to improve its infrastructure, I'm sure. And yeah, it's an upfront cost, but we're already paying that, and we'll recover a lot of that cost. There's a return on that investment. So our country has to smarten up. There's no signs that it's doing that, but every little thing helps. So that's why I bring it up. Oh, there was one more Latin American story, and someone asked me to on Twitter to talk about it. It's actually not a story I care very much about. It's Bolivia's demand for access to the sea. They lost access to the sea from Chile in a war over 100 years ago, 150 years ago, I think. And ever since, one of the main themes in Bolivian society is access to the sea. And there's a big conflict, unnecessary conflict between Bolivia and Chile because of that. And recently, a UN-level court rejected Bolivia's latest claim and latest demand of Chile to have direct access to the Pacific Ocean through a little narrow strip of land in northern Chile. Now, it's not so bad for Bolivia. Chile does accommodate Bolivia. It allows Bolivia to kind of operate a customs authority in the Chilean territory that's under Bolivian supervision. They don't charge Bolivia any extra, you know, fees for doing this, and they give Bolivia ground transportation access through Chile to take products from the port into the Bolivia, which is landlocked. I get that this is important for the Bolivian people, and it's an important issue there, but it just never moved me that much, even though I'm predisposed to be in favor of anything that Bolivia wants. So to me, it's just not that important story. The UN ruling was 12-3. I think it's not going to happen. They're not going to just get Chile to give them a strip of land. I don't know. I'd like Bolivia to move on a little bit from this. And as I look down my list, that's actually the last thing I have. So that's going to... No, I have another story, I guess. France. So in France, a while back, there was a foiled terrorist attack. Fortunately, it did not occur. And the authorities investigated and found that Iran was behind the terrorist attack. So France froze the French assets of what they call in the article the Iranian spy agency. And I was wondering, this is weird. No matter what you think about how we should treat Iran, whether you're in favor of diplomacy with them or confrontation, never mind that. But if Iran has a spy agency, as people call it, an intelligence service, of course France, I'm amazed they didn't freeze the assets of this Iranian intelligence service 30 years ago. Any country that has a spy service and then has money banked away in other countries, of course, all the countries should freeze those assets immediately. The world is a fascinating place to me. It reminds me of in the years after the 9/11 attacks, many years later, you'd read an article about how the U.S. Treasury Department froze a few more assets of the Taliban or some al-Qaeda-related groups, or even the Pakistani government. I said, what, years later? Why does it take so long? Why do these freeze all of the assets all immediately for all of these terrorist groups, including Iranian spy agencies? If they need money, if Iran, they have the right to have an intelligence service, but then keep your money in Iran. You don't have to save it bank it in France. So I just find that kind of thing strange and weird. And there's, of course, more to it than what I'm presenting, but that's how I see it for the moment. And yeah, that's going to wrap up this Friday postgame show. I want to thank you. Like I said, thanks especially to all the new members. I hope you enjoy this. Next week we should have Malcolm and Steve back to do that postgame show. It's a relief when Malcolm does it. I hope we can bring you more than just weekly world news, but we always seem to run out of time. We'll have to try to speed that up and get in here earlier. And so we'll try that next week. Have a good weekend, and thanks again.